Here is a working hypothesis for our lead story today. Wall Street is a jerk. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 22nd of May today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The corporate news, this Monday, comes to us courtesy of the letter F. The ticker symbol, of course, for one of the most iconic of American companies, Ford. CEO Mark Fields is out as of this morning. A guy by the name of Jim Hackett is in. He was most recently in charge of Ford's autonomous vehicle division. Bill Ford is the executive chairman of the company that bears his name. Mr. Ford, it's good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Kai. It's great to be here.
Why'd you make this change, sir?
Well, you know, this is a time of great change in our industry, and we have unprecedented opportunities in front of us. We needed a transformational leader like Jim Hackett, who's done it before, transformed an entire company and industry, to great success. So, you know, it's unusual times that we're in, and it requires a different type of leadership.
Let me ask you a more focused question then. Mark Fields was with the company for 25, 28 years, groomed for the CEO role, was there for 3 years. Would he still have his job if Ford's share price was still at $17 where it was 3 years ago when he got the job?
Well, you know, the share price is a fallout of a lot of different things. Mark did some great things for the company, not the least of which delivered us record profitability over the last several years. You know, we have the financial wherewithal to create our own future. For that, I will always be enormously grateful to him. Mark had a great career, and he did great things for our company. We're in a different time now, in a different place, even than we were 3 years ago. We have different competitors coming into our space. The rate of technology is just exploding. And we need to speed up our decision-making.
That's it. You just need to move faster.
We need to move faster with great clarity so that everybody understands where we're going, our employees, our investors, and the public. And there's a balance because you don't want to tip your hand too soon. You don't want to telegraph every move you're going to make. And yet you also have to be clear enough so that people understand the mission you're on and they buy into the mission.
You have the best-selling vehicle in the country, the F-Series pickup. You have for decades and decades and decades. How hard is it going to be for Jim Hackett to take that, right, to take that sales profile and the profit that comes with it that Wall Street really likes and keep investing in the future of this company?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the F-Series. There's tremendous amount of change in this F-Series versus the old one. I mean, we went to all aluminum. We introduced the EcoBoost engine, which allowed people to downsize their engines in a space where some people said customers will never accept smaller engines. And all we're going to do is continue with that pace of innovation, but always, always knowing what the customer wants.
You say you need speed in decision-making in this company. How much time do you figure Jim Hackett has to get it right?
Well, I mean, there's no stopwatch. It's really, you know, it's a progression. But I know Jim, and I know how he likes to work. And I think you'll start to see things from Jim pretty quickly.
Bill Ford, he's the executive chairman of the Ford Motor Company. Mr. Ford, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
There might not be an official stopwatch running, but the markets wait for no one. So we've called Dan Neal, the car critic for the Wall Street Journal, to get a little bit more perspective on the Ford news. We got him on Skype, as you will hear. Dan, it's good to have you back.
Nice to be here.
What do you make of Bill Ford's stated reason for this change, that basically the company has to move faster?
You know, I don't know. First of all, I feel bad for Mark Fields because what does a CEO have to do but deliver record profitability for 2 years in a row, revolutionize the truck business, you know, to make all these strategic right calls and then have, you know, this is the investor class has cold feet. And that's the bottom line. If you look at Ford's stated reasons, look at the language. Forget what Bill Ford says. The profitable growth, profit pillars. Investing prudently, cost cutting, all this is code, right? This was a decision that was driven primarily by the drop in the stock price.
Do you believe then that Jim Hackett, who used to run Smart Mobility, that is to say the driverless car division of Ford, do you believe he can do anything better? Can he get the company to the future faster?
Well, I don't know if he can get there any faster, but I do know that the externalities that he faces don't change with his new job. Innovation is measured by cubic horsepower, cubic dollars. It is there's simply no way to sort of maintain these expectations of shareholder relief and innovate the company. Mr. Ford said it was a difficult time in the car business. Absolutely. The horizon that we're looking at is right upon us, and we're looking at maybe a loss of 2 or even 3 million unit sales annually. And, you know, if anything, I thought Mark Fields played the game too well and too corporately. I'm surprised that they didn't find Mr. Fields, whose presentation is as polished a corporate entity as you will find outside of Mars. you know, it's just this guy is really was groomed for the position, and I'm surprised he's out.
Dan Neal writes on cars and a bunch of stuff for The Wall Street Journal. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Pursuant to my theory that Wall Street is a jerk, Ford shares up 2.1% today on this news. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Even though the president's overseas, the wheels of government grind on back home, which is why Budget Director Mick Mulvaney is going to be on Capitol Hill this week testifying about the administration's new budget proposal, the details of which we expect tomorrow. It is widely expected this budget to include massive cuts to Medicaid, $800 billion in cuts over the next 10 years, and states would get more flexibility to impose what are known as work requirements, meaning, just like it sounds, people who receive government assistance, including Medicaid, would be required to work. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on that.
The basic idea behind work requirements is pretty straightforward. The belief that people who can work should if they're going to get government support. But currently, most people who receive Medicaid and who would be required to work are actually already working.
Nearly 8 in 10 non-disabled adults with Medicaid coverage live in working families, and nearly 60% are working themselves.
Hannah Katch is senior analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. So if most people are working, work requirements would fall on those who are not. The question is, why aren't those people working? Lynn Caroli is a senior economist at the RAND Corporation.
In many cases, these are individuals who have low levels of education, may not have sufficient job experience, or they have other barriers that mean it's harder for them to work, to hold jobs.
Other barriers might include mental health or addiction. And there are some areas of the country where unemployment rates are still high.
If you impose a work requirement, but there aren't really many jobs available, then that's kind of a double whammy.
James Ziliak directs the Center for Poverty Research at the University of Kentucky. Research by the CBPP looking at the effects of the 1996 welfare reform, which introduced work requirements, suggests that requiring those least able to work, has negative consequences. Hannah Katch.
Over the long term, not only did employment not increase among those who were subject to a work requirement, but deep poverty actually did increase.
Applying work requirements to Medicaid or expanding them for other programs, says Katch, would probably have similar results. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Speaking of welfare and work requirements, have we got a podcast for you? It's called The Uncertain Hour, Welfare, Work Requirements, and Unintended Consequences. You can get it at marketplace.org. President Trump, as we know, has an affinity for Mar-a-Lago, his resort in Florida. Chinese President Xi Jinping and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe have been guests, very public guests at that facility. So on the theory that somebody is always listening, a couple of weeks ago, Jeff Larson and some of his colleagues from ProPublica and Gizmodo found themselves on a boat in a lagoon just offshore from Mar-a-Lago. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell me what you guys did, literally, like, how'd you go about it?
So we rented a boat in Palm Beach, Florida, and drove it down the intercoastal waterway to Mar-a-Lago, and we pointed a Wi-Fi antenna at the shore and picked up their Wi-Fi. And what we found was that this Wi-Fi wasn't particularly securable, right, which could allow foreign intruders to listen in on sensitive conversations.
You did versions of this at the Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, where the president was a couple of weekends ago, also at the Trump Hotel in D.C., where he has been during his presidency and where some of his cabinet lives. Tell me why, although it seems self-evident, but tell me why weak cybersecurity at these places is a problem.
It's not clear that the president ever connects to these networks. When he travels, he has his own network. But what could happen is a hacker or a foreign adversary could connect to these networks and take over all of the devices like cell phones or computers or laptops and turn them into essentially listening devices to overhear sensitive national security conversations happening at these places.
In theory, you could have joined these unsecured Wi-Fi networks that you found, right? But you didn't?
Not at the clubs, we did not. But at the hotel, we did join the Wi-Fi network just by typing in any random room number. And we were able to see that the public-facing IP address of the hotel was running software that was released 13 years ago.
Do you have a sense, and again, the president travels with the White House Communications Agency, and those networks, one assumes, are secure. Do you have a sense of the differing levels of expenditure and security at, say, Camp David, which is the presidential retreat up in the mountains, versus, say, Mar-a-Lago or Bedminster?
So the government spends $2 million on cybersecurity alone at Camp David and the White House. By comparison, Mar-a-Lago Club was forced to publish its budget, and we got our hands on that, and they spend, I think, on the order of $400,000 on security in total, which it's unclear how much of it is actually spent on cybersecurity.
What has the White House had to say to you or the Trump Organization for the hotels and the clubs? Have they said anything to you about this?
The White House did not say anything to us. The Trump Organization said that, like most great American businesses, they're under cyber attack by terrorists every single day. But they do have continuous monitoring, and they do claim that they keep tabs on it.
Jeff Larson covers data security for ProPublica. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
The most appalling and shocking thing to us is that we actually felt we were doing the right thing.
Prosecutors had different ideas, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 89 points this Monday, 0.4%, 20,894. NASDAQ up 49 points, about 0.8%, 6133. The S&P 500 up 12 points, about 0.5%, 2394. Defense contractors got a big lift today. President Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia and news of that $110 billion military equipment sale. Lockheed Martin climbed 1.5%. Boeing rose 1.6%. Today, investors liked the news from Ford's executive suite, as we told you. Ford up, GM up as well, 0.6%. Tesla, though, took a hit. Shares off 0.1% today. Tech stocks helped a little bit. Apple up 0.6%. Google parent Alphabet up 0.9%. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.25%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
On our podcast, Make Me Smart, we ask our guests this.
What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
If you play by the rules, you win.
Hard lessons from Elevest CEO Sally Krawchuk. Stunning realizations, though, from TV legend Norman Lear.
I wouldn't have said that I was capable of murder.
Trust me, you got to hear that story.
Yeah. And of course, a really important lesson about livestock from the CEO of Reddit.
I thought that a pony was a baby horse.
Turns out it's not. It's just a small horse. Come join the conversation at marketplace.org/makemesmart.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is a paraphrase, but one country's protectionism is another country's jobs program, which gets us to the macroeconomic word of the day, trade war. Yes, it's a strong term, but that is pretty much what's brewing on the border, the northern border to be specific. New timber tariffs imposed by the Trump administration on Canada could save mills here in the United States, but at the cost of Canadian jobs. Earlier this month, there were layoffs at 7 sawmills in Quebec and in British Columbia, a major exporter of softwood lumber. Mills and timber workers there are bracing for more. Montana Public Radio's Nathan Hedgie reports.
I'm at a gas station right next to a sawmill in southeastern British Columbia, a few miles north of the U.S. border. Workers from the Wynwood sawmill filter in and out, buying bags of chips and hot dogs. Betty Ann Gordon is the gas station's owner, and she's at the counter, ringing people up.
I mean, there's three shifts working there. I believe there's, I don't know exactly how many are working right now, but I believe it's around 90 people or 100. You know, that's a lot of people.
Like many folks around here, Gordon's business depends on the mill. And right now, she says, there's some uncertainty.
Nobody knows. Like, nobody knows what's going to happen, right?
In April, the Trump administration slapped tariffs on softwood lumber coming across the border, making the wood up to 24% more expensive. It's something U.S. lumber producers have been asking for, and it's a test of Trump's America First trade policy. But it could also cost British Columbia over 1,000 timber jobs. Ron Toyota is the mayor of Creston, B.C., a 10-minute drive north of the U.S. border.
Your government's trying to create jobs. Our government's trying to create jobs. And so if we're all trying to create the same job, somewhere along the line, someone wins and someone loses.
And Canada is putting up a fight. It's threatened to ban or tax U.S. goods coming across the border, including shipments of coal through a seaport in Vancouver. That port is a lifeline for Cloud Peak Energy, one of the largest coal producers in the U.S. Canada has also proposed aid packages to assist forestry workers and companies hurt by the duties. Timber layoffs aren't new in Canada. When a trade agreement with the U.S. lapsed in 2000, Canada lost 20,000 timber jobs. Since then, some of the country's largest lumber producers have hedged their bets against potential tariffs by purchasing sawmills in states like South Carolina and Georgia, where the lumber they make won't be taxed by the duties. Harry Nelson is a forestry professor at the University of British Columbia. He says these larger companies could also benefit because they own a lot of mills.
So if they've got to reduce production, you know, they can at least kind of shut down maybe one of their mills, but still keep their other mills going.
But Nelson says not every timber company has that flexibility.
And that's not an option for a smaller company that may only have one mill.
And it's these small family-owned mills that'll come out bruised.
They're the ones that have got the most to lose.
That's Tanya Wall, a local politician in Creston. She also works at a small family-owned mill and says these duties could cut into profit margins, eventually costing money and jobs. Money and jobs the United States wants. Gordy Sanders is a resource manager at Pyramid Mountain Lumber in Seeley Lake, Montana. He says Canada took advantage of an expired trade deal in 2015 and sold lumber at unfairly low prices here in the U.S., and that hurt mills across the country.
You know, the last couple of years, all of us, the small family-owned mills in the U.S., have suffered financially.
There were layoffs, shift cuts, and mill closures. The new duties, Sanders says, could help even the playing field and eventually save some timber jobs in the U.S.
Sheds a little light at the end of the tunnel.
But that same light is dimming for timber jobs in Canada. And when I tell this to Steve Johnson, the sales manager at Pyramid Mountain Lumber in Montana?
Well, I don't like to hear that. I don't like to hear anybody losing jobs, but we were kind of in the same boat before the duties. So I hate to say it's us or them. I'd like it for us to be both, but we need to be competitive with each other, too.
The Trump administration is expected to announce a second round of duties on Canadian softwood lumber that could cost even more jobs north of the border. In Creston, Canada, I'm Nate Hedgie from Marketplace.
I'm going to ask you a trivia question here that's not really a fair question, but it is a good way to set up this next piece. Anybody know, off the top of their head, the name of the only bank in this country indicted for mortgage fraud after the financial crisis? Yeah, I didn't think so. I didn't know it myself until I saw a new documentary film that's out about it. It's called Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. Abacus Federal Savings Bank serves the largely immigrant community in Chinatown in New York City. It's a solid bank, but small. Assets are about 1/100 of 1% of Bank of America's, for some context here. But after the crisis, Abacus became the focus of a mortgage fraud investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney, the first such investigation since 1991. The bank was started 30 or so years ago by Thomas Sung, a Chinese immigrant. It's now run mostly by his daughter. Steve James directed the film. Jill Sung is the CEO of the bank. Her sister Vera is on the board of directors. And they all went to our studios in New York. Welcome to the program, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks. To be here.
Steve James, let me start with you and ask you how you found out about what is kind of an amazing story.
Well, I didn't find out from reading the newspaper, that's for sure, because no one was covering this story in the mainstream media. I found out from Mark Mitten, one of the producers who's been a family friend of the Sungs for 10, 12 years now. he called me up and told me there's this like crazy story going on in New York with this small bank that was the only bank that was to be criminally indicted in the wake of the 2008 mortgage crisis.
Say that again. The only bank.
The only bank.
Indicted.
Yes. A small Chinese-American community bank in New York City. They are a big bank. They're the 2,651st largest bank in the United States.
I thought you said we dropped.
You did drop one notch, but I didn't want to rub it in.
Oh, man. Jill and Vera. So let's explain what happens here, I guess. In 2010, you two discover that some loan officers at the bank have been altering mortgage applications, basically fraud. You fire them. You contact the police yourselves to report the crime. But after you report it, you begin to realize something. And let's play that piece of the tape right here.
You know, at first you think that they're here to figure out what's going on for us because they're law enforcement. I don't know where and at what point we transition to...
In their mind, yeah. To
in their mind, and then us realizing, wait a minute, you know, maybe we're the target.
It was the moment you realized that the DA was going after the bank.
Correct.
Not the employees who had committed the fraud. Jill, tell me about that.
The most appalling and shocking thing to us is that we actually felt we were doing the right thing compared to the other institutions, the larger institutions that appeared to cover things up or wanted to turn their back away from it and not recognize what was happening. We said, okay, here's something we're investigating. We're letting you know. We're telling you. But instead, we were punished as if we were the bad actors, and the bad actors who were not good actors were let go. And that's what's very infuriating and actually is quite concerning because it creates a reverse incentive.
Steve, you sat down with Cyrus Vance Jr., the DA in Manhattan, the guy who brought the charges, who took the case to trial. What was his explanation for why this bank, the 2,561st or whatever it was, biggest bank in the country, was the one that was indicted for mortgage fraud after the financial crisis?
Well, I mean, it goes back to when he announced the indictments. He made a big show of connecting the charges they were bringing against Abacus to that mortgage crisis, which was ludicrous. And so when I talked to him in the interview about this and I said, this bank versus the big banks, why these charges? He said something I think very revealing. He said, yes, it's true that what the big banks did was less than ethical. And I thought, less than ethical. I mean, that's a euphemism. And then he quickly went on to say, but what Abacus was doing was just, you know, just as bad and a part of that. And I just think that it just became clear to everyone, the Sung family and us as filmmakers, that this case was so important to him because he wanted to be the prosecutor who took down a bank in the wake of this crisis, whether this bank had anything to do with that crisis or whether, in fact, as it turns out, whether they were innocent or guilty.
Jill and Vera, it bears a mention here that Chanterelle, one of your sisters, was actually working in Cy Vance's office, in the DA's office, when these charges were brought. I mean, there's a terrible poetry here.
Yes. One of the hardest things for us when this was happening, when we realized that we were going to be indicted, was how are we going to let our sister know? Because she is actually working in that very office. And we were really concerned about her and her job there and not wanting to jeopardize anything. It was very difficult for us. We actually kept what was going on with us from her for some time.
Really?
Yeah, we didn't want to endanger her. We didn't want her to feel conflicted or anything. So we really did until we felt it was important to tell her because we also didn't want her to be also blindsided.
That moment comes on screen, and she's clearly distraught.
Yes, I think she felt very betrayed.
Steve James, as you are shooting this film in real time, you obviously don't know what's going to happen verdict-wise. 240 individual counts, a trial that takes like 80-something trial days. I don't even know how many calendar days. Would this film have been made had the verdict gone the other way, I guess is my question.
Absolutely, it would have. In fact, that was one thing we talked with the Sung family about when this was all going on, was that, you know, regardless of which way this verdict goes, we have to make this film. And I think it's to their great credit that they accepted that. And my perception was they believed so firmly in their innocence, and they recognized that this was a significant case that went beyond them. It was a case about their community, too, that even if the verdict went against them, that wasn't going to change how they felt about their mission, about their innocence, and about this bank.
Jill, what has business been like at the bank since the verdict, which was, I guess, like 2 years ago?
For the first 12 months after the verdict, we were still struggling. The past 6 to 8 months have been much better. So I'm happy to say that the future looks good.
Jill and Vera Sung, the story of Abacus Bank is told in Steve James' latest film. It's called Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with this by way of background, fidget spinners finally made their way to my house this weekend. Those spinning little things that the kids spin between their fingers when they fidget, I guess. Anyway, now comes technology to ruin it all. I saw this on Mashable the other day. There are now fidget spinner apps for your phone. You swipe your finger on your screen, the image of the fidget spinner spins, and thus the whole bleeping point of the thing is completely missed. All right, got to go. The Dow up 89 today, 0.4%. NASDAQ up 49, that's about 0.8%. S&P 500 up 12 points, about 0.5%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.